All right, here we go.
Hello, and welcome to the JuntoCast, a podcast on early American history. I'm Ken Owen, Associate Professor of Early American History at the University of Illinois Springfield, and author of the book Political Community in Revolutionary Pennsylvania, 1774 to 1800. This month on the podcast, we're going to revisit Hamilton the musical, 5 years after it first appeared, and consider how much our opinion of the musical has changed, how much changes in political and popular culture have influenced the way that the musical is received by the public, and generally considering the ways in which the musical has influenced the field of early American history. I'm looking around and thinking how lucky I am to be alive right now, and joined by my two good friends, Michael Hattam and Roy Rogers. Michael is Associate Director at the Yale New Haven Teachers Institute and author of Past and Prologue, Politics and Memory in the American Revolution. Thanks for being here, Michael.
Hello, Ken.
And Roy is a history teacher at the District of Columbia International School. Thanks for being here, Roy.
Howdy, Ken.
I did mention that we are revisiting the topic of Alexander Hamilton. And before you listen to this episode, if you're not familiar with the JuntoCast back catalogue, there are a couple of episodes we might suggest that you listen to in conjunction with today's episode. The first is episode 20, where Michael, Roy and I were joined by Nora Slonimsky and Joanne Freeman discussing Hamilton. And they continued their discussion with us for an extra episode on the Hamilton moment, which you'll be able to find in our podcast feed immediately after episode 20. So some of what we talk about will be referencing things that we talked about back then. So please do check those episodes out if you haven't already. Just over 5 years ago, a musical that started at the Public Theatre moved into the Richard Rodgers Theatre on Broadway and into the American popular culture and really American popular consciousness as well, as American historians, and particularly historians of the American founding, it was quite strange to find the events of the Revolution, the ratification of the Constitution, and the politics of the 1790s being not just referenced in the media, but enthusiastically referenced by a much broader and more diverse audience than normally discussed early American history. At the time we recorded an episode on Hamilton and on the musical's relationship with historical scholarship, but more recently Hamilton came back into the popular consciousness after a recording was included on the Disney Plus platform over the summer. And we thought that with it being 5 years since that explosion of interest in the musical, now might be a good time to look back at the popular culture phenomenon that it spawned and to think about the broader impact. Roy, what thoughts do you have on the phenomenon?
One of the stranger things about Hamilton was one day, just suddenly, a bunch of friends and acquaintances had really strong opinions about what you could say before the musical were really obscure-ish historical figures, or at least somewhat forgotten by the general public. You know, if you had mentioned Aaron Burr to somebody, in 2012, they probably wouldn't have known who you were talking about, but suddenly they had very strong opinions about whether he was a hero, villain, misunderstood. And as someone who in their sort of non-professional life spends a lot of time in fandom spaces, one of the stranger things and one of the things that took me a little bit of time to sort of grapple with was that there was now this Hamilton fandom that operated on principles that were no different than people who really love Broadway musicals, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or various other, you know, pop culture phenomenon. And it operated and was debated not on terms set by historians or the historical record, but set by the work of fiction itself and by the ways in which fandoms interact with each other and have their own sort of internal dynamics that are really alien to you if you're used to approaching, you know, the object of Alexander Hamilton or the person of Alexander Hamilton, you know, as a historical figure. Because, you know, in graduate school, we debated whether, you know, lots of things about Hamilton, his political career and his life. And then I've taught about Hamilton and his political career and his life before the musical. But now there was this extra element of, you know, people having opinions on him that, again, were only partially related to the, you know, figure of Hamilton, the Federalist that you encountered in graduate school or taught and went over with your students. So that was sort of one of the biggest things that took me a while to sort of come around to as I experienced the phenomenon myself.
I'm really intrigued by this idea of fandom. And I wonder, Roy, if you might expand on that a little bit, actually. And talk a little bit about, you know, what some of the similarities you see to the other areas of fandom that you have sort of, you know, a lot of firsthand experience with.
I mean, I'd say most of the similarities are pretty similar for people. You know, if you are, you know, a fan of, again, I'll use probably one of the more mainstream ones, you know, like Marvel movies, you know, like people develop strong, close personal connections to various characters, right? And they'll get various merchandise with that character's image, you know, and, you know, there's, you know, all kinds of, I don't want to go too much into the weeds of this for our audience, but, you know, there are people who, you know, become invested in the different relationships within the fiction itself. So people can become very invested in Hamilton and Eliza and Hamilton and Angelica and Hamilton and Burr and put their own twists, you could say, on what those relationships are that don't necessarily have a one-to-one or one-to-two or one-to-three or one-to-four or one-to-five relationship with what is in the original text. And then people, again, develop these really they create and synthesize their own personal relationships with these characters and create fan art, create fan fiction, you know, costumes, cosplay, those sort of things. And encountering that in the wild at conventions, again, that's based on something, a subject matter that, you know, I know well from a professional capacity was definitely a head trip, I guess you could say. And one of those stranger things would be talking with friends and acquaintances. And again, they would have very strong opinions about Alexander Hamilton in a way that, you know, previously maybe George Washington or Abraham Lincoln would be someone, or Franklin Roosevelt would be someone that, you know, you'd be at, you know, you'd be having dinner with people who don't really care about history. And, you know, like, oh, you're a history teacher, you're a historian, you're in graduate school. You know, they might ask something about George Washington or something like that, but they now have, well, you know, Hamilton, you know, was a hero or Hamilton was a villain. And talking and about those sort of things, it was quite interesting. And I think one of the other things is that always struck me about Hamilton fandom is how much it's spread throughout parts of the population that, you know, you usually wouldn't, you know, where history, interest in history isn't necessarily something that is immediately coded to that part of the population.
One of the things that interested me about that was the cottage industries that spawned around it as well, that the Hamilton mixtape and the remixes and so many recording artists recording their own cover versions, and the interest any time that demo tapes or drafts or versions of songs got the didn't make their way into the final version of the musical, the excitement around that. What was it, the book that came out that Lin-Manuel Miranda called the Hamiltome, I think? And like the interest in all that associated merchandise was something that was fascinating to me about the cultural reception. Michael, do you have any thoughts on this? Because I do want to come back to a couple of other things that Roy said, but that will take the discussion in a slightly different direction. So I'll give you a chance to respond.
I would say, thinking back, and you know, when Hamilton hit, I was in graduate school. I was in my third or fourth year of graduate school. It was intense, I think, to be an early American historian, early American history grad student. And I think, especially at the Revolution, and I think that was probably for a couple reasons. First was just how intense the attention to the musical was. I mean, you know, I remember when it hit at the Public Theater, you know, being in New Haven close to New York. And so, you know, I sort of knew that that was going on. But I, especially once it moved to Broadway, I mean, the amount of cultural attention that the musical sucked up was really astounding and really intense. I think partly because of that, because of how much attention it got and how intense it was. I mean, I'd be lying if I said that I didn't feel some anxiety at the time as a historian of the Revolution that this musical was going to have a huge impact on shaping how, well, first students, but even beyond that, just many Americans generally would go on to think about the Revolution for a long time going forward. It was an intense and anxious moment for me as a historian of the Revolution.
We've raised a lot of issues about how strange it was as early Americanists to experience a cultural moment where our nerdy field, where we can often get quite lost in the weeds, suddenly had so much public attention put on it. But perhaps now is a good time to just talk about the musical itself. We're all familiar with the soundtrack. We're familiar with the musical itself. I was fortunate enough to get to see it on Broadway. I don't know if either of you had the opportunity, but it's something that's now part of our broader cultural references. How have our thoughts and perspectives on the musical itself changed over the 5 years since it first hit the big time?
Put really simply, I think that as time has gone by, and I had a chance to see it on Broadway with the original cast that I missed out on, but I ended up seeing it live in Chicago a few years ago, which was pretty good. I think that as time has gone by, I have sort of been able to actually enjoy it more as a work of art, as a musical, as a batch of songs. And I think part of that has to do with talking before about how anxious, you know, and how intense the moment was from the perspective of being a historian of the Revolution. That has sort of subsided over these past 5 years, and I've found myself able to just enjoy the musical more on its own terms without worrying about all the baggage of being an early American historian and being a historian of the memory of the Revolution. I think I'm able to enjoy and appreciate it, I should say, more now than in the original moment.
I definitely have similar feelings to Michael, although unlike either of you, I have not been able to see it live, either with the original or with one of its traveling casts. But it is a banger. Like, I mean, there's no other way to say it. I think it's a really good musical. And I mean, particularly, I think it's very strong at the beginning and the end. Is just some really, really good musical theater and fun stuff. And, you know, it's one of those things that one of the reasons why I think it has developed like such a cult following, particularly among people who love musical theater, is that it's, you know, in one part in conversation with things that, you know, the three of us know really well and many of our listeners may know really well, which is early American history, but it's also in conversation with musical theater itself. And that's sort of, you know, something, you know, I was able to appreciate the more I listened to the soundtrack. And again, some of the songs just are really good and catchy. And I think, you know, like Michael, I think that historiographically, some of the baggage has fallen off, mostly because you know, the last 5 years have been, what's the best way to put this, contentious. And it feels like some of the debates around Hamilton, and we'll get to this, I guess, when we talk about impact and interpretation, you know, feel like they come from beyond the veil, right? That they, or they're from a lifetime ago. And that, you know, both the field of early American history and the our politics and culture have in many ways shifted so much that it feels like some of the initial fire over Hamilton, you know, ended up not really signifying as much as we wanted, because there were some other major changes in American culture, or not even changes, but major themes of American history that were going to be brought to forefront just a short year later. And, you know, if that kind of makes Hamilton appear as a historical artifact of an era of the past, not of our present, which is, I think, a weird thing. But I have that feeling about a lot of pop culture that was created before November 2016.
I'm trying hard not to be the curmudgeon.
Yeah, okay.
because I...
Since when?
Yeah, I since when? Thank you, Michael. You know it's serious when Michael Hatton's calling you the curmudgeon. No, I really do think it's a great musical, and I agree with you, Roy, on as far as the narrative and the way that the storyline develops. There's a lot of great songs. There's a lot of dramatic tension. The thing that gets me every time, though, is that the songs that really stand out to me are character studies that rely on very particular readings of the historical figures, some of which I think are actually quite accurate. I'm thinking about Wait for It by Birdsong. I think that's a really fascinating song, but it's much more about inner drive in a way that you could give that song to that type of character and it would make sense. It doesn't have to be in the context of the American Revolution or the early American Republic to have that sort of impact. The songs that actually deal with history, I think, are remarkably poor a lot of the time, actually. I know,
like,
the one that, and I'm probably going to get a lot of hate for this, is The Room Where It Happened. Because, and I remember watching an interview with Miranda, and he basically said, I couldn't find a way of making the stakes of the dinner interesting. Mm-hmm. And there I am. Yes, I'm a political historian of the 1790s, but this is something that Hamilton thinks the fate of the Republic hangs on.
Yeah.
And Miranda can't find a way of having Hamilton, his central character, make that interesting. And so he has to pivot to another character and basically push the historical content right to the side into asides in the song. And there's something that I find with the art of the musical very good, but it's a particular way of addressing themes that are important to Miranda, as you'd see in his musical In the Heights, that don't really fit with the history. So I have this love-hate relationship in that I think musically there's a lot that's clever about it. Theatrically, there's a lot that's very well done, and the performances are fantastic, in the same way that Howard Da Silva's Benjamin Franklin became the popular image of Franklin. I think that David Diggs's portrayal of Jefferson is becoming the way that people remember Jefferson, for example. And that is no small achievement to be able to take a character like that and to make him your own.
Doesn't hurt that he has one of the better songs. So,
was there a song that you did like, that you did think the history was done well in?
I'm just running through.
I actually think Jefferson's introductory song does a pretty good job of setting up who his character is in the both in the context of the play and uses the details of Jefferson's life at that time in a way that fits the play and stays true to the history, I think. It's not obviously doesn't talk about everything about him and you know brushes over other things, but I think it does a good job of that's a moment where I think there's a good fusion between the needs of the play and the history of Thomas Jefferson himself. And again, is one of the reasons why he's such a memorable character alongside Miranda and Miranda's Hamilton and Burr, even though Jefferson's not actually in that much of the play.
I think a lot of the ones where the history is handled well, it's either because the historical event is part of character development. So I think the where Hamilton is debating with Samuel Seabury is done very well, but that is as much for the character exposition as it is for the historical content.
Yeah.
And the other song that I think sticks out when you ask the question would be Ten Dual Commandments, but of course that's setting the scene for what are the rules of the stage at this point, rather than dealing with specific events. So I think that's one of the challenges. That's why I feel like I'm a curmudgeon when I'm talking about this. It is very clear as someone that can pick up on the references and the reading that Miranda has clearly done to research and write, that he understands the period and that the choices that he's made are made from a position of knowledge. And I don't want to sort of sound like I'm being a scold because I'm saying, oh, you should have just interpreted it in a different way. But it is notable to me that it's the characters that shine through and not necessarily the stakes of what is being portrayed that they're fighting over. That really got lost and subsumed in personality clashes in a way that still jars with me. Hamilton was an asshole, but he wasn't hated by so many people just because he was an asshole. He was hated by so many people because the policies that he stood for, many people thought were going to ruin and undermine the American Republican experiment and potentially turn the Republic into a monarchy. And that really does get lost. And that's something that will always sit uneasily when I think about the musical.
Well, I mean, I think it's very important to remember. I mean, this is the thing, right, that Miranda has a very... what's the way to put this? A very depolitical read of the character of Hamilton in the context of both, I think, in the context of the 1790s, but also in the context of how historians have debated him, you know, particularly in recent years, maybe the last 20 or 30 years. It's like a much older vision of Hamilton from many ways, like the progressive era of Hamilton that sort of Miranda imbues. You know, a lot of that has to do with what his primary source was that he used, and the ways in which he politicizes Hamilton are not in the terms that you set out there, Ken, right? About, you know, it's that Hamilton's policies are assumed to be part of the American Republican experiment by the play as it's laid out, right? And so that makes the stakes of the political conflict much more personal and, you know, much more ideological in a way that, you know, rests uncomfortably with our historians' understanding of Hamilton. I mean, particularly areas around slavery, which I think we should maybe get to maybe in a little bit. But like, that's one of the big sort of takeaways of things that get really brushed over in the play that like we're really, really starting to re-examine right now, very publicly by some excellent public historian, public scholarship, about, you know, Hamilton's relationship with that institution, which would not have gotten the public press it has gotten today if it wasn't for the play, and of course wasn't for Disney bringing the play to Disney Plus over last summer.
But at the same time, the fact that everything is done in that personal way means, for example, that when they sing he's never going to be president now, it's not because of his Federalist policy program, it's because of his affair. I mean, we know there was no chance that he was ever going to be able to be president before that happened. That is not the moment. I know there's artistic license. I know that you have to make cuts and you have to push things together. But by pushing it to being Hamilton's failings were of a personal nature and not a political nature, I think that actually misses out for some even better potential moments in the play.
I agree with that. I think it's not just his policies, right? There is an aspect of the reason that he was disliked. Part was his policies, which many people thought were, you know, pseudo monarchical. But it's the way that his personality intersected with his politics and his policies. He was not a pleasant person to do politics with or to be involved in any kind of political context with, right? Now that's something, and that has an impact on how people viewed him at the time, how much he was disliked. Most of the time he was a half decent political strategist. Then there are other times when he's a very bad political strategist, and a lot of that has to do with him letting his personality get in the way. There's stakes there, and there's a conundrum there. Like Ken said, there's more there that could have been mined to bring out the drama of that moment of the idea of him not being never being president, but even just generally, I think Miranda went for the personal, which is the move that you would expect in a form like this. But I think that there were some roads not taken there that could have still involved personal stakes in the politics of the time.
We've talked there about our reactions and our changing relationship with the musical, but we've also got a changing relationship with the impact of the musical as well. Roy, you mentioned earlier the very obviously changing culture and politics of the United States since the writing. I think many commentators have pointed out how this in some ways is the creation of the Obama era and was the last big pop cultural phenomenon that would be quite so closely tied to the Obama presidency. And of course, the politics of the 2016 election really did get taken to the Broadway stage when Mike Pence turned up as vice president-elect to watch the musical and was addressed directly in the curtain call as he was sort of hurrying out of the theatre. And there was a lot of tension about whether it was appropriate for Pence, having been on the ticket of such a divisive campaign, to then be present at a musical, a large part of whose cultural cachet came from its celebration of the immigrant experience in America. How would we discuss the musical's impact both in the moment and presently? Is this something that has had a lasting impact on cultural discourse, or is this something that became a historical artifact remarkably quickly?
I mean, I think, you know, so I was taught the Revolution before Hamilton and taught it after. And this is just from my perspective in the classroom at the time in the years around the musical. It was clear that in the year or two after it hit Broadway, that like a large portion of my students had either seen it or were listening to the soundtrack, and sort of like Roy had described earlier, had become really huge fans, even if it's just of the soundtrack. That said, about a year ago this time, I surveyed a class that I was teaching, an all first year seminar. I asked how many of them were familiar with the musical, like were fans of the musical, basically. And it was like one out of a class of 20. Now, I mean, I can't extrapolate that out to what other people's experiences were, but it seems to me, from my very limited perspective, that the star that was the Hamilton musical did seem to burn out relatively quickly, at least among that sort of age demographic?
Well, I think for me, encountering this, there's sort of two phases of this you could see, which would be like the initial wave, which would be that, say, first year, year and a half, when, you know, the soundtrack really had hit, people were able to say it. You know, I was living in New York at the time, so that's definitely a very, and also spending a lot of time with people who study early American history. But even among my students, there was like an awareness of Hamilton and questions from students about it, and they came with their fandom and things like that. And that, you know, died, you know, there's been a lot going on in American culture in the last few years. So I would say probably by 2017, maybe the zeitgeist of around Hamilton had faded away. And I come to the point where, you know, many of the students that I worked with didn't, you know, they were vaguely aware of it, or like I would make a joke. They'd be like, what is that from? And then like from the Hamilton musical. And they'd be like, oh yeah, that thing. That changed though with the Disney Plus, this summer. It came out on Disney Plus. It was my first time to actually see the performance myself. And coming into this new school year, of course, this was at a new institution, overwhelmingly a majority of the students across, you know, a variety of backgrounds had seen it, because a lot of them had access to Disney Plus, and or through friends and family or through their own, you know, or their own accounts. And, you know, there was a lot more awareness of it, right? You know, and I got questions about it. It's come up about many times, even though we haven't really done a unit on the American Revolution. And there, it's definitely back into the cultural consciousness. And a lot of that, again, has to do with accessibility, because in many ways, this is an era of where it's accessible again. Like, it faded away because, again, you know, it wasn't that accessible beyond the soundtrack. So once those initial, you know, interest in it faded away, it wasn't like your average person could afford to go see it, right? But now that it's on Disney Plus, which is a very popular streaming program that families and social networks have access to, so they can watch the Disney movies with their kids, or watch Marvel movies, or watch The Simpsons, or whatever else you use it for, you can also watch Hamilton. And it's definitely much more in young people's cultural discourse than it was initially. I think it's a much more complicated discourse than it was initially. Mm-hmm. People are much more skeptical of it than they were in 2015, 2016. But it's still very much present.
That's interesting. I wonder how much your location has to do with this. And I imagine that Ken is going to talk about this too. But the musical, you know, was being staged on Broadway in New York City, and then pushed out to the rest of the country through tons of, you know, local productions, right? There was a production here in Chicago, which I got to see. So in lots of cities, there were productions. I'm sure there were probably lots of high school productions of it in smaller towns. So whereas in New York, it might seem like it had run its course, I wonder that probably was not the case for the rest of the country.
Yeah. I mean, I experienced the phenomenon from the Midwest, and yeah, a town that likes its historical heroes. Yeah, I walk a couple of blocks and I get to shake hands with a new bronze statue of Abraham Lincoln. There was enough of an interest, to be sure, that those traveling shows that you talk about, Michael, definitely generated a significant amount of local buzz when they hit through the regional theatres. You know, I remember the St. Louis, the traveling show when it came through St. Louis got quite a big amount of attention. There's been a lot of people that were interested in coming up from central Illinois to Chicago to see the company's performance there as well. In the classroom, though, I never had that much of a reference. There may have been one or two students in a class, you know, and I teach the survey class, 30 students once a year. I maybe one or two students in any iteration of the survey class would have come across it when someone else in other classes came across it. You could see the blank looks on the faces of the other students when they asked questions. And I have noticed that there is both a East Coast bias, and I think that's understandable. I'm trying not to use that in a politically pejorative sense, because I think there's just something about something that's going on as a live event in New York is going to interest people that can travel to New York easily more than it's going to interest people in central Illinois. But I also think that one of the things that seemed very fresh about Miranda's musical in a New York and Broadway context was the fact that it had a cast entirely cast from people of color, that it was using rap and hip hop, and Miranda clearly was demonstrating his fandom of rap and hip hop music in very detailed and intricate ways within the soundtrack. And I think that made the interest in the storyline of Hamilton appear much more progressive than it was. I know I wrote about this at the time. I wrote a piece for the Junto blog where I basically called out a lot of academic historians that were talking about how new and innovative this was, saying that the fundamental narrative was Ron Chernow's, which it is, and when Ron Chernow wrote it, historians panned it and said, this is founder chic, this is consensus history warmed over. And I want to go further with this, because the references, the circles in which Hamilton continues to get referenced are policy circles, are think tank circles. They are circles where the form appears more radical than the substance of the musical. Last year, I was at a student conference where the keynote speaker was referencing Hamilton. And again, I looked around the room and it was clear that most of the students were at best not engaged with the reference and at worst confused. And I do think that 5 years later, that still stands out to me. There is a big clue in the fact that Dick Cheney and Mike Pence felt comfortable turning up to live productions of Hamilton, an American musical, and that might have given an opportunity in different circumstances for other conversations to have taken place. But I think it does mask that the core thesis of the musical was not as radical as it might have seemed.
Yeah, I have to say, and this goes back to a point that you just made, Ken. I mean, what I think that what remains most striking to me now, still 5 years later, about the initial reception, was what struck me at the time was just how much historians embraced the musical, right? It was exciting to see the revolution sort of come center stage in American popular culture, right? And that sort of combined with the politics of the musical led to, I think, a lot less criticism of the musical's depictions and its inaccuracies than it probably should have received. I mean, you know, you sort of alluded to this. I mean, the musical was clearly in the founder chic tradition, having been based on Ron Chernow's biography, and it's sort of, you know, focus on the importance of the individual and of character and determining the sort of outcome of the revolution. And historians had spent, you know, the previous 15 years or so rightly criticizing books like Chernow's biography and many others like it. And so there seemed to me at the time, you know, to be a very big disconnect between the way many historians treated those works and how they received the musical. And I mean, I think part of the real problem with that, at least from my perspective, came from actually how well Miranda sort of leveraged the interest in and the approval of academic historians, not so much to promote the musical, but almost as a sort of seal of approval for the history that the musical depicted. I mean, He used historians' sort of public praise of the musical, especially on social media and in interviews, as this sort of seal of approval. And I would say about a year after the show had been on Broadway and had been this massive success, that's when many historians, you know, really started to engage the musical critically in both popular and academic venues. But in some sense, by then it was kind of too late to have a really significant impact. Even though those critiques are still usually valuable now, and they're out there and they're findable by anyone who is, you know, first encountering the musical now, say on Disney Plus.
I think, though, it is easy, though, particularly for us who are familiar with Founders Chic, and, you know, I think have all been critical of it at different times in their professional career, and you know, when we were all writing for the Junto regularly, to focus in on that part of the musical. Which I agree with you both, that, like, that's something I've had trouble with and still have trouble with. I think that the vision of Hamilton there is a very small C and big C conservative, and a vision of the revolution in a conservative way that I don't feel comfortable with. At the same time, though, imagine, and this is where I think the alchemy of this and the beauty of Hamilton and why I can't entirely quit it or denounce it or say it's bad, is the vision of the founding being primarily driven by characters who are not white, and then recasting all those founders as black and brown people. Yes, that is not, you know, yes, I wish also Miranda had told the story not from Ron Chernow, but he did. And that's a whole different thing that we've unpacked some. And I'm actually happy to unpack more about a couple of things I think the musical crosses over. But that is a really important, and it's something different about how the revolution is depicted in pop culture. That is really important. And, like, really should not be downplayed alongside other criticisms. And it's one of the reasons why people, I think, do continue to glam onto this interpretation of Hamilton. You know, George Washington being a black man is a very radical, different way of visioning American culture and what the American Revolution means, even if it sits alongside this very traditional conservative vision of the American Revolution within the same play. And that's something I definitely do not, I think both deserve to be talked about.
But while I take on board what you're saying there, Roy, if we think of the way that historians approach trying to write histories that have a greater involvement of people of colour, we might think, for example, of ways that historians of the Civil War have emphasised the importance of self-emancipation and decentering Abraham Lincoln and other white political leaders in favour of looking at the long-standing, organizational, incredibly risky efforts that were taken by black abolitionists and by the enslaved breaking their bonds of slavery and striving for freedom themselves in a way that places people of color at the center of that narrative, whilst actually talking about people of color. And I agree that there is something that is interesting and symbolic about the casting of George Washington or Thomas Jefferson as people of color. That does have problems in and of itself. And I'm sure we are going to get to the politics of Hamilton and slavery very shortly. But it's a way that allows people to reimagine the revolution as more radical without actually having to fundamentally change what they think the story of the revolution was, in a way that when we look at other histories that incorporate people of color, it requires a much more fundamental and radical rethinking of historical agency and historical change.
Oh, that's definitely true, Ken. And I think one of the criticisms of this is, in many ways, like, you know, an Obama court play is, you know, around those issues, the ways in which it represents the Obama's era's rethinking of what the American, or no, not even rethinking, reshuffling what a lot of the traditional American narrative is without changing it and leaving out a lot of stories that, you know, are later going to really come to a head, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years of our experience, right? Like, and some of these are themes of the play, which is, you know, the stories of immigration and immigrants and, of course, slavery and the history of, you know, Black struggle for freedom and equality, you know, which are themes in the play, or particularly the questions around slavery and Black freedom are sort of sub-themes. But the immigrant story is very much the theme of the play. And, you know, it's not a, you know, it's not really a story that, you know, sits comfortably in 2021 that it may have in 2015. Even if it maybe in 2015 shouldn't have sat comfortably. And that is very well taken. And the play has a lot of problems. But what I think continues to make it such a powerful work of art is all of the things that we've been talking about here, both the, you know, some radical elements to it, but also the ways in which it speaks to this ingrained American narrative that, you know, someone has recently written an excellent book on the origins of, published by Yale University Press.
I mean, I have to say, I admit, first, thank you for that, Roy. I will PayPal you later. I think the musical really is inseparable from the politics of the late Obama era, right? The blurring of the racial lines that's done by the cast. And there's a fantastic article that was written by Lyra Montero. And this is, you know, within the first year of the musical. And it's one of the most significant critiques of the casting, of the politics of the casting. I mean, I would urge all our readers to go online and find that. The article was originally in the Public Historian. But I, you know, I think the blurring of the racial lines, to my mind as a historian of memory, really reflects the sort of overzealousness for a sort of post-racial United States in the Obama era. And then, as you mentioned, there's the focus on immigration, which was a central issue of the both Obama administrations. But then there's also the sort of Horatio Alger aspect of the story, the sort of rags to riches aspect of the story that is squarely within the sort of the realm of conservative themes of American history, but also was promoted by Obama's own use of that type of the parable of that myth. You know, as someone who's currently working on a book about the history of the memory of the revolution, the musical is so significant that you have to address it because it was so significant on its own, but also because of the way it really reflected the time in which it emerged.
One final issue that we've alluded to but haven't addressed directly yet in this episode is recent scholarship by Jessica Serfilippi, who has conducted extensive research into Alexander Hamilton's connections with slavery. The musical portrays Hamilton as very ardently anti-slavery in his political character. But Sir Felipe's research uncovers Hamilton's direct involvement in the purchase and sale of enslaved people. It makes it clear that he was a arbiter in the legal system in cases involving enslavement, and suggests that at certain periods in Hamilton's life, he may have owned enslaved people as well. Clearly, this stands in quite sharp contrast to Miranda's portrayal of Hamilton, and Miranda very much takes his lead from Chernow's biography. Chernow and others who have written on Hamilton from a much more positive perspective particularly point to Hamilton's long-standing membership of the New York Manumission Society as evidence of his anti-slavery credentials. From my perspective, someone who knows the field but hasn't looked at the documents directly, the news that Hamilton is that intricately involved in the trafficking of enslaved persons was not a surprise to me. If you look at the family that he marries into, his extensive connections within the business life of New York City in the time period, it is inconceivable that someone could have his prominence without having been directly implicated through his family and his business connections. Nevertheless, this is significant, I think, in how we interpret the musical, because one of the things that we talked about in previously is how it would have been very difficult to take a founding father who was known to have been an enslaver and to cast a musical entirely with people of color and make that founding father the hero of the narrative. Roy, what is your perspective on the recent news stories?
Well, definitely, I guess I have a slightly weird perspective about this because I went to graduate school with several people who studied, you know, issues around slavery in New York. So Hamilton's involvement and the sort of historiography around it is something that I was, you know, somewhat familiar with before this. But I think on one hand, it would not have become a national news story that, you know, is at the front, you know, one of the top stories in New York Times, think pieces on Vox and the Smithsonian, really digging into it in a way if the musical hadn't existed. And that, I think, is one of the more positive aspects, if you could say, you know, from historians and history teachers, is that it does give a platform for reconsiderations of them. You know, and the same with the Schuyler family in general. They have gotten more interest thanks to the musical, you know, particularly the women in Alexander Hamilton's life have gotten, and historians of women's issues around those things, both fashion, but also the lives of those women themselves, have gotten more, you know, room in the press to be able to raise them. But I think to go to your specific political question about this, I think it really does highlight the ways in which questions around slavery, which if there is one thing that historiography of the last half century, at the bare minimum, maybe a little bit longer, is that slavery and questions around it are one of the central themes of the era. And the fact is a sub-theme that I noted earlier of the play, and it's cast in very dichotomous terms, right? Where the good guys of the play, Hamilton, Lafayette, are not, they're, you know, and Lawrence, you know, they are, you know, anti-slavery, and they want to, you know, they have that whole tidbit about Lawrence wanting to raise a free, you know, African-American regiment and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, the villains, Jefferson, Madison are enslavers, are Virginians. And, you know, Washington kind of sits in the middle and, you know, says, you know, I'm from Virginia too. But Washington's own history of enslavery isn't super mentioned in the play either. You know, and it's cast in this dichotomous terms. And one of the reasons why Hamilton doesn't like the Virginians in the play is that they're enslavers. That whole framework that Miranda sets up, that he does inherit from Chernow, but is also his own intellectual, political, and artistic scaffolding, just collapses, I think, under the weight of this this new research. And I think it is something that, as people are grappling with this as a cultural work over time, are really going to have to take into sharp consideration.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that my initial reaction to Sir Filippi's really excellent work was very much like Ken's. That is, you know, an utter lack of surprise, right? I had always thought that Chernow initially and by extension Miranda had overplayed Hamilton's anti-slavery credentials. You know, being a member of a manumission society is very different than being a member of a abolitionist society, right? And I think Roy is absolutely right that this work by Sir Filippi really does shake the edifice of that aspect of the plays, the musical's moral scaffolding, not just historical scaffolding. Also, I hope that it will be the case that since her work rightly got so much attention in sort of mainstream media, that people who encounter the musical now for the first time, say on Disney Plus, you know, when they go online to look for more, the coverage of her work will hopefully be prominent, and hopefully that will cause newcomers to the musical to apply a more critical perspective or lens to the musical than it was possible for maybe many of the people who encountered it, you know, during its sort of initial heyday.
Absolutely. And I think for all that I've said, that the conclusions didn't surprise me. The work is mm-hmm. excellent in its detail and its clarity. And I think for us working in the field, it's reminiscent of work like David Waldstreicher's on Benjamin Franklin, or most notably Annette Gordon-Reed's on Thomas Jefferson, where it's things that aren't hugely surprising to people at the cutting edge of the field, that these relationships and these stories are not as clear-cut as popular memory would like the stories to be, and that all the scholars mentioned there have very clear and direct evidence of the founding fathers and their connections to enslavement and trafficking in very direct ways. One of the things that I hope it might lead to, although it has been a little bit depressing in the broader discussion in the press, is that it might lead to a recognition of the complexities of anti-slavery thought broadly considered in the late 18th century. I know it's always difficult to draw historical parallels, and I don't want to seem like I'm cheapening things by making comparisons to the present, but there are many people who live today who believe that climate change is a severe and pressing problem and still engage in all sorts of economic activity that contributes very directly to climate change. I think that the same thing can be true, and indeed is true, if you look through the roles of the New York Manumission Society. There are many members of the Manumission Society who are enslavers, who are traffickers, who profit out of a close involvement in enslavement, and nevertheless claim that they are working towards manumission. That does not sit easily with 21st century morals, where it is you can either be a good guy or a bad guy, but clearly the way in which the institution of slavery and enslavement was tied up in 18th century society was far more complicated for many of the people who believed themselves to be doing moral things. That doesn't mean we have to like them, but I think if we want to understand this period on its own terms, we have to resist that urge to have uniformly good and uniformly bad guys, and recognize that one of the reasons that this took decades afterwards to be resolved, and even then was only resolved at the cost of hundreds of thousands of lives, is because of the difficult ways that it was enmeshed in society, and therefore the difficult ways in which people's political thought was influenced by the institution of slavery.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that, you know, that I've used that analogy to climate change in the classroom pretty regularly, and it seems to have had something of an impact, you know, at least in shaping the subsequent discussion about these issues.
That brings us close to the end of the time that we've got for discussing Hamilton 5 years later. But as we normally do, let's finish with one round the table question. 5 years later, how would you describe the significance of the musical in both the short and the long term? Michael, do you want to go first?
Sure. It's hard to judge the long term. I mean, 5 years is not the long term. But in the short term, it generated a significant interest in the Revolution and early American history. But at the same time, from the anecdotes that I told earlier and from things that both of you have said, that interest doesn't necessarily appear to have been especially long-lasting, though now there is this sort of second life for the musical, thanks to Disney Plus. I mean, I always thought that its significance would be down to how much further people went, you know, in learning about the actual history. I said this years ago, but if someone saw the musical and then followed that up by only reading Chernow's very problematic biography, that had the potential to actually have a sort of net negative effect on how many Americans understood the revolution. But clearly there's no way to know how much further people went in their own historical interests sparked by the musical. But I would also say that the musical is significant because of its place in the history of the memory of the revolution. First, it is squarely within the tradition of founder chic type writing about the revolution, as we talked about. And, you know, I would certainly make the argument that in many ways it's the culmination of that genre of writing about the revolution. But at the same time, I think, you know, it clearly went way beyond any sort of individual founder chic work in sort of seeping into popular culture and into American consciousness. And it did that really more than any event since the bicentennial. And that's the last great moment when the revolution sort of claimed this much attention in our popular culture. And so for that reason, it has a real significance for historians of memory like myself, you know, in addition to its cultural and maybe even political significance.
Well, as long as it's helped you in your career, Michael. Roy, what are your thoughts?
Sitting here 5 years after the musical, I have to agree with a lot of what Michael said, where I think that its big contribution is it added some new tropes and reworked a lot of longstanding tropes about the founding, and sort of maybe kind of also as a person who sort of kind of saved Alexander Hamilton's popular memory, you know, in a way that I think will really have long-term impact. I think, you know, it may have for a while at the very least boosted Hamilton into a level of historical memory of alongside Washington and Jefferson and from this era, you know, in a way that he kind of like fades in and out. I think that sort of he's at least got maybe another decade or two before he'll fade entirely from memory again as, you know, and become a sort of first tier founder. So if you're sort of following the founder's rat race, you know, it's very important, you know, for that aspect. I also think it's a really interesting, and this is something I alluded before, that so when I think about Hamilton, I think about the ways in which it was where history culture and historiography collided with fandom culture and created some really interesting and different ways of consuming, you know, historical literature in a way in which you had professional historians and fans. And when I say fans, I mean that in the way in, you know, in a you know, very specific meaning where I'm talking about, you know, people who are making fan fiction, making fan art, cosplaying, you know, this kind of fandom, where they were having a similar conversation and were in the same intellectual, cultural, and political space, which very seldom happens, you know, even with historical fiction, like that, like Outlander doesn't really do that, or Turn, the Revolutionary War TV show, didn't do that, but Hamilton did. And that was a really interesting cultural moment that I think has had some pretty interesting repercussions where many people who are fans did become more interesting interested in history and read, you know, Joanne's book and also Ron's book and other, you know, other history books. You know, they weren't necessarily reading people's dissertations, but they were interested more in history, and also led to some historians becoming more interested in engaging with fans. And that is one of the things I'll probably remember about that Hamilton era more than anything. And I think the other, of course, major legacy to think about is its political legacy, which we've talked a lot about in this podcast. And we are not a political podcast. We're not a cultural analysis podcast. So I'll spare listeners really in-depth, my own in-depth views about this. But I think the political legacy and the ways in which Hamilton will remain, I think, a really important cultural artifact for the transition from the Obama era to the Trump era, and sort of its reconsideration at the end of the Trump era when it's released at Disney Plus, is a really important cultural moment that I think future scholars of this era we'll come back to, because I think that the play speaks to a lot of themes of our era. And as we lay out here, sometimes in really interesting ways, sometimes in really problematic ways, but never in boring ways.
I'm taking notes from everything Roy said so I can use them in my book. Again, PayPal will follow shortly.
You have all this talk of fan culture, Roy, but I know for my part, I am going to keep plugging away at my Albert Gallatin fan fiction until my checks come in.
You're going to come for me, Ken? I can't respond. Is that what I have?
All joking aside, although I do have this pipe dream of a Swiss fugue about the life and times of Albert Gallatin that I can just see making musical and political headway in 300 years time. But being serious and turning my attention again to that question of popular culture, one of the things that strikes me about Hamilton is that for all that I disparaged the people who still make Hamilton references as being very likely drawn from a particular political class, there has been something both in 2015 and in 2020 with the initial release of the musical and with Disney Plus that transcended the disparate state of popular culture. It was really interesting to me when I went to see the musical on Broadway in 2016. I'm a big sports fan. I'm not a pop culture expert. I just about know if I see someone in red, white, and blue spandex, that's probably Captain America, but that's about as far as my knowledge goes. But the energy that was outside the Richard Rogers Theatre that night was akin to the anticipation that I've seen at the biggest sport events that I've watched. It was like that sort of frenzied atmosphere of anticipation that I saw when I went to the London 2012 Olympics. And that was really striking because this is an era when even niche niche popular culture that's very well done, that attracts an avid fan base, often remains niche. And Hamilton permeated into popular consciousness in a way that lots of other things just don't, and therefore remain outside of my general sphere of knowledge. That, I think, tells us something about the lasting importance of American civic identity. It tells us something about the lasting importance of the small c conservative old story of American civics and the American founding identity as well, that I think is easy for those of us working in the field to ignore. And I think that although Hamilton, as you say, puts this very new step on it, it's not entirely surprising that it does hew to some quite old customs as well. And that in hewing to those older customs, that's one of the ways that it was able to hint at the formation of some form of monoculture at a time when consideration of popular culture has become so fragmented amongst so many different audiences. And I think that will probably be one of the things that people notice 10 years from now. There will be very few things that really attracted prolonged engagement in the popular culture sphere. Anything that's gotten similar attention since has kind of zoomed in and zoomed out of consciousness. And I think Hamilton had a bit more staying power. And that was where Miranda was really smart in attaching his thinking about immigrant narratives to the American founding. That gave his ideas much more sticking power. That brings us to the end of today's discussion. But if you'd like to hear more from us or get in touch, there's a number of ways that you can contact us. You can find us on Twitter using the handle @JuntoCast. You can find us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thejuntocast. And you can go to our website, www.thejuntocast.com. If you prefer to get in contact via email, you can email us at thejuntocast@gmail.com. The JuntoCast is available in a number of different podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts. If you subscribe to us through Apple Podcasts, please take the time to leave us a review. We really appreciate it, and it helps other people find our work. That brings us to the end of today's show, which leaves me to thank Michael Hatton for joining me.
Thank you, Ken.
To thank Roy Rogers for joining me.
Thanks, Ken.
And to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in. We hope you'll join us for the next episode.
All right, here we go.
You talk all... You have all this talk...
I'm going to keep that.
You heard that or not.